We will hear argument next in Niazi Licensing Corp. against St. Jude Medical, number 211864.
Well, Darren, I think we're going to have a physical exhibit. Or maybe not. I thought we were going to get an exhibit. That's in the box.
Mr. Griggs, and if you don't mind, why don't we start with the question whether you all belong here at the moment.
Yeah.
Bring us up to date.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Good morning. My name is Michael Griggs. With me is Miriam Wynn from the Boyle Fredrickson firm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, on behalf of the appellant Niazi Licensing Corporation. To address the jurisdictional issue,
If it's possible for you to speak up a little bit, that would help me.
Certainly. I guess, the microphone's over here. I've spoken with opposing counsel on this, Mr. Shaw, and I believe we're all on the same page. The parties jointly submitted a notice of dismissal under Rule 41, and we believe that was sufficient under Rule 41. It's our understanding
Did you file something in the district court yesterday?
We did file
what
a supplemental filing. That was a joint motion for dismissal as opposed to a notice under Rule 41. So we've made two filings. Like I said, with respect
And the yesterday's has not been acted on?
That has not been acted on. And I can assure the court that we've been acting with utmost diligence in attempting to get this resolved. From our perspective, the parties are all in agreement that this counterclaim of invalidity with respect to Claim 11 should be dismissed.
Right, but the part of the issue is that these jurisdictional finality questions involve more than just the interest of the parties. They involve, at least in addition, the interest of the judicial system that is reflected in the pretty strong, though not absolute, finality policy that, for example, the district court may really not want to see any piece of the case again, and therefore the district court has an interest in deciding whether there is something still to be done, which there are mechanisms, some of them as to which there are inter-circuit conflicts, but nevertheless, do you know of any case that supports the notion that for this particular purpose of a agreed on dismissal without prejudice of a remaining claim that we recognize, as do a few but not many circuits, that can achieve finality, but where that any case that says that can achieve finality in the absence of the district court's approval of it?
Your Honor, I haven't found any. I am not aware of any case that says that. And I guess further in response, it's our understanding and hope that what we're waiting for is simply a ministerial action by the clerk of court there to dismiss the case. We don't have any understanding or expectation that the district court would wish to pursue this any further, and I know I've been checking my email.
But if the district court were to say, no, I don't,
I don't go with a dismissal without prejudice because that has no effect, really. I end up getting the case back if you're not satisfied with, or if they're not satisfied with the result they get from the Court of Appeals, because it'll be back on the validity question. So the district court were to say, suppose the district court were to say, no, your request is denied to dismiss. It's not, it is a choice that the district court has to approve at this point, I believe.
Your Honor, and I don't disagree with that, but there is discretion involved. Yet, again, the indication was the judge dismissed the case and closed the case down upon resolution of the summary judgment motion. So I believe that's an unlikely outcome here. And like I said, our expectation is that she will grant, or the district court will grant the joint motion.
But until that happens, we really can't assume full jurisdiction over this case, right?
I mean, I guess that's an assumption that the court can make or not make. But as, like I said, I've been checking my email pretty frequently here, hoping for a notice of dismissal that has not been entered yet. And
counsel, when you receive something from the district court, is it your plan to notify this court? I just, for example, I didn't know that you had not filed, for example, a Rule 28J letter to say that you had filed a motion to dismiss. Do you plan to inform us if you do get a result from the district court?
Yes, yes, we plan to notify you immediately. And like I said, I wish I could give that notice as I'm standing here. But as of this moment, we do not have an entry of dismissal.
Okay. Why don't we discuss the merits?
Thank you, Your Honor. I presume the court is familiar with the technological issues and the nature of the case. Very briefly speaking, this patent is directed to two things. It's directed to a telescoping catheter system that is used to plant pacing leads in the left ventricle of the heart via the coronary sinus, and it's also directed to a method of implanting a lead using that telescoping catheter system. As the court is certainly aware, there are a number of issues up on appeal. I'd like to focus on the first issue that we raised, which relates to the district court's ruling of indefiniteness with respect to two particular claim terms.
But before you get to that issue, could I ask you just briefly to turn to the summary judgment issue? Because I have a couple of questions on that. I want to make sure that we don't spend all of your time on the first issue. Is there, in your view, a difference between subselection and cannulation?
Yes, and thank you for raising that issue. And that actually dovetails with the two benefits that the patent improved on over the prior art. Cannulation is accessing the coronary sinus. And so in order to do this procedure, you first need to access the coronary sinus, which, you know, as described, it's in a chamber in the heart, and it's slightly raised off the floor of the chamber.
Could you not say that if you were cannulating one of the could you not say that one could cannulate one of the branch veins as well?
Yeah, I believe cannulation simply means accessing.
Right.
I don't.
So for cannulation, again, when would you say something is, let's say, cannulated but not subselected, or subselected but not cannulated? I'm trying to see the difference between the two terms, if any.
And I think in the abstract, there is no particular difference there.
Okay.
What it's referring to is inserting or placing the catheter in a particular vessel, in this instance within the heart.
So subselecting would be putting the catheter into, in this case, the branch vein?
Yes, and I think perhaps the difference in terminology is, cannulation generally means, as you just mentioned, inserting or placing a catheter into a branch or into a vein. Subselecting, I think that's a little more particular in this context because there could be more than one branch vein. And so as the physician is doing this, they use fluoroscopy, and they get an image of the particular region of the heart in which they're operating, and there could be numerous branch veins. And so I think that's the derivation of the term subselection, wherein, all right, we've already accessed the coronary sinus, and from there there are you know, a number of options that you could follow. And so I think, again, subselection is merely choosing which branch vein you want to go into. But
does it include not only choosing which branch vein you want to go into, but also going into it?
Yes. I mean, that is what the procedure is. It's subselecting that vein. And, you know, as described in the patent, the catheters serve as a pathway for the lead. And so you insert the catheter basically as far as it will go into that branch vein so that you can support the lead as you're entering it and placing it in the desired location within the heart. Your Honor, did you have any?
That's it.
That was your only question on summary judgment. Thank you. So back to the indefiniteness issue.
I'm sorry, I have another question. Suppose that the only thing that you prevail on in front of us here is a reversal of the indefiniteness of invalidity of all the claims but 11, and that everything else stands. Do you have the ability to make an infringement case for those other now revived claims on remand?
Oh, certainly. For example, claim one is an apparatus claim. There's no inducement based on that, so all those considerations relating to inducement do not apply. It's a straight-up application of the claim to the apparatus.
Okay. Does the court have to address the damages issue with respect to expert report that's talking about apportionment of method claims if method claim 11 is not infringed?
It's a slightly more complicated question because some of the, at least one or two of the claims were also method claims that were invalidated via the indefiniteness ruling.
This is 25 through 27.
I'm sorry?
Claims 25 through 27.
Yes.
So the answer is yes.
Yes. At the very least, it would, you know, it would put those claims back in play, and those claims were not subject to the summary judgment motion. So I believe the court would need to reach a ruling on the damages issue just for completeness. So again, back to the indefiniteness actually, I see I'm almost getting into my rebuttal time.
Please continue.
I'll pick it up in rebuttal.
He didn't hear you say.
Oh, no, please continue.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
I was saying I'm essentially at my rebuttal time now, so.
Right.
So
I'd like to you to continue your argument now.
Oh, yeah.
And you'll get some rebuttal time back.
I'm sorry. Thank you. I misunderstood. So, again, very briefly, with respect to indefiniteness, the two terms at issue here are an inner pliable. I'm sorry. Let me get this. Right. An inner pliable catheter and an outer resilient catheter having shape memory. As we set forth in our briefs, these terms should be afforded their plain and ordinary meaning. You know, there are instances that raise questions under Section 112 indefiniteness. There are a few different types of categories where you need to conduct additional analysis, looking to the specification, looking for objective boundaries. Those categories are typically terms of degree, for example.
Counsel, did you remember correctly that you gave dictionary definitions to the court about this? For example, I think you had one that said resilient means returning to the original form or position after being bent, compressed, or stretched.
You know, I would have to recall. I know there were dictionary definitions submitted, and I know, I believe that the plaintiff's pliable definition may have derived from that. I believe the plaintiff relied on the language and the specification with respect to resilient. And I apologize because at that point in time on claim construction, there was at least one other party that was involved in the case that has since is no longer part of the case. And so you're testing my memory a little bit as to who submitted which dictionary definitions.
I think you submitted it. It's on page A2963. I guess I just thought that it supported your position to the extent I was curious, thinking about the argument of redundancy that was made by the opposing party. And I was thinking maybe it is redundant to a certain extent to say resilient and shape memory, but that seems to be what the definition of resilient is.
And I completely agree. It's not redundant. And in a case cited by St. Jude Bicon, this court has said, you know, the point of redundancy, you want to give effect to all of the claim terms. And construing resilient in accordance with its ordinary meaning does give effect to the term shape memory. And so I don't believe it's redundant. And I actually, one of the other cases that we cited, it was the claim language very similarly reflected that. And I'll see if I can, maybe on rebuttal I'll pull that up. But it was written in a similar fashion where it said a resilient material that, and then basically followed with the generally understood definition of what resilient is. And, you know, again, I don't think that raises any concerns under Section 112. So I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you. Well, we will restore the, 4 minutes
okay.
that you had reserved.
All right, thank you, Your
Thank
Honor.
You. Mr. Shah.
Good morning, Your Honors. May I proceed?
Yes, please. I'm sorry.
May it please the Court. My name is Cal Shah, and I represent St. Jude Medical SC, the appellee. This morning, Your Honors, appellant has asked this Court to review 7 issues. Importantly, 4 of those issues are subject are discretionary discovery issues, and 5 of those issues have been reviewed at least twice, either upon reconsideration by the district court judge or upon a challenge to the magistrate judge. And quite frankly, Your Honors, I think what appellant suggests to this court is that somehow the district court was a rogue court that needs yet a third review, and we would disagree and respectfully
well,
add.
We have the issues that are presented, and at least for me, I'd like to just talk about the substance of the correctness of the challenges to those issues that you want to engage, not anything more general or subjective.
Absolutely, Judge. And so let me turn to, I think, a couple issues that I think are important. First, in our view, the claim construction and the non-infringement rulings are dispositive. On the claim construction side, with respect to indefiniteness, we believe that the court's construction was correct. Obviously, Your Honors get to engage in the standard here is de novo review, but according to the law, under de novo review, and this is the Nautilus case, a claim is invalid for indefiniteness if it fails to inform with reasonable certainty those of skill in the art.
Why is the word pliable not, you know, it might be broad, but why is it indefinite? I mean, pliable has a dictionary definition of easily bent. Why is that difficult to understand?
A couple things, Your Honors. First, it's not that it's indefinite in the general context. Of course, we have to look at it into the context of the claim and as it's used in the specification. And that's what makes it indefinite.
I understand. There's that sentence in the specification that says both the inner and the outer are both pliable or easily bent and also resilient. But the thing is, the claim says that the inner catheter is pliable. And the dictionary says that means easily bent. Of course, we're supposed to look at the claims from the point of view of a person of ordinary skill in the art, not even myself, and understand whether a person of ordinary skill in the art would know what that means. And it seems to me that easily bent means that you can easily bend it.
Well, Your Honor, that's the exact problem. As we talked about, this is a patent that relates to cannulation of the coronary sinus. Mm-hmm. And so to say easily bent, if it's too easily bent, and that's a term of degree, you're going to have cardiac arrest. And if it's not easy enough to bend, it's not going to follow the proper
Isn't
pathway.
Isn't that a scope problem? I mean, you know, maybe there's a lot of prior art that teaches this, but it's not necessarily meaning that it has to be a particular level of bendiness. There's nothing in the claim to say that. It just says pliable.
Well, Your Honor, I think the scope problem is what makes it indefinite, right? Because we need to apprise the public of what is still open to them. And by simply just saying that this is a catheter, particularly a dual catheter system where one is resilient and the other is pliable, both terms that have very similar meaning, we take out potentially from the prior art of catheters. This is not the first time a double catheter has been in the system. Catheters have been used to cannulate the coronary sinus or at least the body, particularly the heart area, maybe a different part, for decades and years before this. And so it's
what
simply
about the term resilient? Resilient has a dictionary definition of meaning that it can be compressed or bent and it returns to its original form. And then the claim also says resilient and further seems to suggest that that means shape memory. Why is that indefinite?
So there's two issues with that, Your Honor. First, as you point out, resilient is almost the same as pliable, so we have a problem because we now have an outer catheter and an inner catheter that are supposed to have certain reactions. So
I don't think I said that resilient means the same thing as pliable. Pliable means easily bent, and resilient means that when something is compressed or bent, it returns to its original form.
Fair enough. I misunderstood. But the fact that it can be bent is part of the issue here. The second part of it is when it to be able to return to its original form is also problematic. So shape memory, for instance, can mean it returns back to the shape under certain conditions. So, for instance, we're in the heart. You don't want it returning back to its shape at all times. You will tear the vein.
But the claim is broad. It just says it has to return back to its original shape.
Well, that's not what the claim says. The claim says that you have to have an outer resilient catheter with shape memory. And so certainly shape memory may mean, although we believe it means something slightly different, we believe it means it keeps the shape once you cannulate because you don't want it pushing back. But so it takes the memory of the shape you give it as opposed to returning back to the shape. And then it can return back to the shape at a later time, for example, when you pull it out. But to your point,
isn't that reading a lot into the claim?
It's not. It's one of what, to Your Honor's point, it's what one skill in the art would understand. If you have this thing in your heart and it's returning back to its original shape, you're going to tear through the veins. And so the idea here, particularly if you read the patent, is that you're trying to get to attenuated branches of the vein that have odd curvatures. And so in order to do that, the patent tries to teach a system where you have an inner and outer, and the inner apparently has some sort of strength, pliability, that allows it to yet push the outer into some shape, but then not tear through the outer, but also not bend too much so that you have cardiac arrest. On the flip side, there's supposed to be this shape memory component, which should, as I understand it, and I think one of skill in the art would understand, keep it in the shape that you select once you do the subselection.
Well, I'm a little unclear as to what you're defining as shape memory with respect to something that is deemed to be resilient. How would that work?
So what I believe, I guess that's the exact issue here, Your Honor, is that something that has shape memory probably has some sort of resilience. So I guess
give me the definition. Are you saying shape memory means when you twist it in a certain way, it stays that way?
I think that shape memory means that in this context,
or that it remembers its original shape, as in another way of saying resilience.
Well, I think it's the latter in the context of this particular invention, but it would be at what point do you have that shape memory, right? Because here again, you don't want it bouncing back to its original shape like a paperclip perhaps while it's in the system. It may have enough shape memory once it's in a certain condition, but we don't know these conditions, and the addition of the term resilient to the entire system of outer resilient catheter with shape memory adds yet further confusion. And for example, if you look at Claim 10 is a dependent claim that requires that the inner catheter have yet further characteristics that will somehow manipulate the shape of the outer catheter, but the outer catheter has some sort of shape memory and resiliency. And so we're talking about a system that needs to be used inside an individual's for placement of a lead in a person's heart with these ambiguous terms. And the specification only adds further ambiguity by saying things like, the inner and outer catheter have a certain degree of stiffness, yet one is more pliable than the other, and yet there's even a third option, an obturator that's disclosed in the specification that is more pliable and easily flexible. And so we have very ambiguous terms that are used.
But we're not supposed to read all of that into the claims, right? We don't read the specification into the claims. And the claims here, for example, claim one, simply says there's an outer resilient catheter and an inner pliable catheter, right? I mean, I understand I can look to the specification to understand what resilient means and pliable means, but I shouldn't start worrying about what the obturator is described as having as its characteristics when I don't even have that recited in claim one, right?
Well, I would disagree in the sense that I agree, Your Honor, that we don't read the specification into the claims. But when you have terms and a system that has to have certain reactions, we're not just talking about tubing in no context. We're talking about the invention here is that there's a system of an outer and inner catheter that are meant to be somehow manipulated in shape once in the human body. And in order to obtain...
So to make sure I understand your point, I think what you're saying is the words resilient and pliable have to have very special meanings in this case because of the technology in which they're used.
Well, what I'm saying, Your Honor, is the terms resilient and pliable as used in the claim need to have particular meaning, of course, in the context of the patent.
Because
and
it's
the claim
a medical device and it might hurt somebody. Because it's a medical device, because of the technology that's at issue. Is that right?
Absolutely, Judge. I think that's a fair consideration. If this was a garden hose, perhaps you're not as concerned about the inner and outer and whether there's a slight differential. But importantly here, I'm not even asking for absolute precision. And I think it's important to note that even the district court itself said that absolute precision is not required. And there was another term, the catheter, that she construed, and she said that the district court construed. And it said in that context that while it has a certain degree of ambiguity, that it still is subject to construction as it relates to the catheter. But when it came
because
to...
Because the claim used the outer catheter and the inner catheter. When
correct. So there was some, and so one of skill in the art could figure that out. In the context of claim one...
Do you
one,
want to address that claim construction issue, by the way? The issue of whether when it says the catheter is inserted, that means that the simultaneously the inner and outer catheters have to be inserted?
Sure, Your Honor. I think that the district court addressed that issue, and Your Honor is, of course, it's de novo review, but the claim itself, if you look at the claim, says as with respect to the first limitation that the catheter, and let me just find it, Your Honor, so I have
Can I ask you something? Like, it's a comprising claim. So the catheter could be inserted by inserting the inner and then inserting the outer, and still the catheter would be inserted.
Well, I guess a couple things, Your Honor. I would disagree for the following reasons. First, if you look at the claim, the patentee understood how and when to either pick the catheter, meaning the inner catheter or outer catheter. For example, the next, the third step is advancing the inner catheter. And so certainly the patentee, who's the best the arbiter of what terms to use.
Well, maybe they wanted to write it broadly, meaning the catheter is inserted, which means it's broad enough. Just a minute, let me talk.
I'm sorry.
Broad enough that the inner catheter could be inserted followed by the outer catheter.
Well, I think
or
that,
broad enough that they could be inserted together.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's a completely different step. And there are many different ways of doing this, and so that would be yet a different claim. Because the idea here in particular is that you have placement and insertion of the system, and then once that system is inserted to a certain degree, you can sub-select and whether you and then you follow the remaining steps. And so I believe, from our perspective, that the patentee chose the term the catheter as opposed to others. The catheter...
It's a method claim. It's a method claim, right? So it's really the step we should be looking at. The catheter is inserted. So how could that method be performed? Is it broad enough to cover two steps or one step when it doesn't have the word simultaneous or anything else in the claim?
Correct, Your Honor, but from Pelley's perspective, those words could have been added, but they weren't. And so because it does not say sequential, and in fact, I believe appellant suggests that those were taught in the specification. So certainly to the extent that's the case, which the patentee could have used
that. The specification has two different embodiments, one in which they're both inserted together and one in which it's sequential?
I believe the patent has numerous different embodiments and procedures, and there certainly are.
Two, one in which the inner catheter is inserted, followed by the outer catheter, and the other in which they're both inserted at the same time.
I believe that there is the notion that you could put the outer catheter and then the inner, and perhaps them both together, but not
right.
The inner and then the outer.
I got
and,
that.
And so certainly, and I think to be candid, Your Honor, that practice has been going on in the industry for many, many years. The point here is that because it says inserting the catheter and there was no antecedent basis, and we brought this issue up to the district court, and using this court's rules of claim construction.
If I said insert the suit into the suitcase, surely that would not require doing the jacket and the pants at the same time, would it?
I would disagree. I think a suit is the jacket and the pants.
Well, it is, but really inserting the suit into the suitcase would not cover first putting in the trousers and then then putting in the jacket on top of it? Because all this, the only basis we have, I think, is just this language point, right? Not anything more contextual. And the language point seems to be a bit of a stretch.
Well, Your Honor, I mean,
just because the thing you're inserting has a couple of parts doesn't mean you automatically, as a language matter, have to do them at the same time.
Yeah, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree in the sense that I think that in your example that it requires both. But I think importantly here on the non-infringement,
both at the same time or both sequentially?
I believe that if you say inserting the suit, you would add the suit together. And if you say insert the suit pants or insert, now again, that's a patent
claim.
What if you
had said inserting the clothes? Same thing? They all have to be put in together?
I think, Your Honor, I think in that context, inserting the clothes could mean separately. But importantly here, you know, well, since we're talking about the non-infringement perspective, the district court considered many other aspects. So just whether Your Honors agree or disagree with the appellee on inserting the catheter, there are other significant aspects. For example, there's no evidence of direct infringement in the record. That was admitted by the appellant on December 2nd, 2019, after the close of fact discovery. Also important on the non-infringement perspective is that three of the steps upon which appellant relies cite if desired. And if I may,
This is in the instructions?
In the instructions. And you can see that in Appendix 2314, Your Honors. That's the instructions. And importantly, at Appendix 1454, we note that when I had asked appellant's expert, what does if desired mean, he said, quote, desired is sort of a vague term that puts it in the hands of the doctor. And so that renders the steps and the instructions as a whole optional, and under this court's precedent, HZMP Medicines LLC versus Actavis 940 F3rd 680, that cannot be the basis of encouragement, but another basis.
Let me ask you another question dealing with the same issue. Do you think that the IFUs of St. Jude, and then specifically I'm addressing the sub-selection / cannulation IFUs, can be read by reversing the order of, I think it's 4 and 5, of the, I believe those are the right numbers. Is that a permissible reading of the IFUs, or do you think it's not?
Are you talking about claim steps 4 and 5 of
yes.
the IFU?
Yes.
No, Your Honor. So one of the things, and I think the court found this as well in the summary judgment finding, and our position on behalf of appellee is that St. Jude's instructions in the IFU, and this is at Appendix 2314 where we have a comparison, teach a completely different step.
Well,
so
you just said something that troubles me, which is you said the court found that these could not be read in that way. Why is that an issue on which the court is entitled to make a finding? Because this is summary judgment, and the question, this is a fact question, is it not, for the jury? Isn't the question whether there is a disputed issue of material fact on which the result is subject to a finding by the jury? Isn't that the right standard?
A couple things, Your Honor. First, to the extent that there's no genuine issue of material fact, that is a fact that the court can consider. And in this particular case, the court understood.
Well, but that's the question. Is this so clear that the jury could not plausibly find to the contrary of your position? You keep saying in this section of your brief, over and over and over, you say the court found and the findings were not clearly erroneous. On issues that are jury questions, that is to say, you're right. There's a summary judgment if no reasonable jury could find to the contrary. But that's not the same as saying the court made a finding which is not clearly erroneous. You understand the distinction?
I do, Your Honor, perhaps.
But that's why I found that section of your brief to be misleading to the extent that you were effectively saying this is a question of a finding by the district court that is not clearly erroneous. That's not the right standard, right?
I agree with you, Your Honor, that it's not a finding of fact. It is a fact that is either undisputed or that there could not be an alternative decision or ruling by a jury.
But that's not the same as saying that the judge's finding was not clearly erroneous, which is something you say over and over again.
And I apologize for the imprecision, Your Honor, but that's That's what we were going for. And I think this sub-selection catheter IFU is indicative of that, and there's a couple other points. But for example, here, this IFU teaches a completely different step, a different process. In this one, in St. Jude's IFU, you are pushing the outer catheter over the inner into the coronary lateral branch vein. In the patent, the idea is you push the inner catheter out of the outer catheter into the branch vein. So that's a completely different process. And so that's the reason, Your Honors, that we believe the district court, not in its finding, but in its determination that there could not be another conclusion, is correct. Another component that we also cited in our brief, Your Honors, is that St. Jude appellant's own expert, when identifying the steps, identified them out of order. And as Your Honor may remember, the court's claim construction order has the steps to be in order, and that's not challenged. And so yet another reason that there could not be infringement based on the IFUs.
Counsel, can I ask you along that point? So your position is that the inner catheter is sent into the coronary sinus branch vein, and then the guide wire follows it.
In St. Jude's IFUs?
Yes.
The way the process works is the inner catheter is put into the outer. You then put in the guide wire, as you can see in step 5. And these are all optional. They're all left to the physician. But importantly, step 6 is advancing the outer catheter over the inner. So you're trying to get the outer catheter as far along as you can into this to sub-select. The patent requires a different option. If you look at the patent, which is at the bottom there, requires that you insert the catheter, but then ultimately you are moving the inner catheter over the guide wire into it. So it's a completely different...
And so instead, the outer catheter is inserted over the guide wire. The guide wire is the first thing that goes into the greater cardiac vein in the St. Jude IFUs. Then the outer catheter is put into the greater cardiac vein, not the inner catheter. Is that what you're saying?
A little bit different, but yes. Okay. So in the St. Jude IFU, you put in the outer a little bit. Then you put in the inner or the guide wire. You put in the inner typically a little bit, but you need to get to a certain distance. And so at some point, if there's instability and you're not comfortable pushing the guide wire because it may not, the outer, because it may not go to where you need. So you stop, you put in the inner. The physician then determines, do I need a guide wire or do I have enough support or stability? And then maybe you need a guide wire, so you put the guide wire in. But here's where it's important.
Is that why there's all this if desired language?
Correct, because it's all up to the physician. It is every anatomy varies, and every patient varies, and every physician's skill set varies.
Well, now I'm confused. Because I understood earlier you were saying that the process in the St. Jude instructions is that you insert the inner catheter into the outer guide catheter, and then you subselect, i.e. cannulate, the desired coronary sinus branch vein with the inner catheter, no guide wire at that point. And once the inner catheter is inside the branch vein, then you may or may not use the guide wire. But that the guide wire doesn't go into the branch vein before the inner catheter. Am I right or am I wrong?
You are correct. And what I was focused on, and Judge Bryson and I apologize, was step 6 further. Because if you look at the patent, it requires the inner catheter to be the one that ultimately gets further pushed along. But in St. Jude's IFUs, they're talking about pushing the outer catheter over the guide wire. Okay. But as you point out rightly, in St. Jude's IFUs, the inner catheter prior to any guide wire is already in the proper vein, which is another reason that the court's non-infringement determination should be applied.
All right, thank you.
So, Your Honors, thank you very much for your time, and we would ask that the court's ruling be affirmed.
Thank you. If we are evening things up, you get 10 minutes. Please feel free not to use all of it.
I will take that under advisement. First, I'd like to address some of the issues that we just discussed with respect to the instructions. And I think there's also a component here, and I don't want it to get overlooked. This court has held that you can rely on instructions to infer intent with respect to inducement. And we are, in part, relying on the instructions here. But as we submitted to the district court on summary judgment, and also as we included in our briefing here, we did have testimony from St. Jude's 30B6 representative testifying under oath that these instructions are their recommendations for how to use the product. This is how we think this product should be used. And so as far as evidence of intent, and this distinguishes over some of the other label cases where, you know, maybe there was sufficient evidence in the form of the instructions to infer intent and others that were not. We have additional evidence in the form of testimony from St. Jude's 30B6 witness. I'd also like to address the notion, and I know...
Who was the 30B6 witness? Is it?
I'm sorry, what was
who was St. Jude's 30B6 witness?
Ooh.
Dr. Bennett?
No, Dr. Bennett was their expert. I would have to go back.
Well, that's okay. It wasn't something that came up in the brief.
Yeah, no, but Dr. Bennett was not the 30B6 right. witness. Just with regard to the procedure itself, I think we're taking, and I don't, again, I we're taking a sort of a theoretical approach to how the procedure works. We provided testimony from Dr. Burke, which is the Yazzie Licensing Corporation's expert, with respect to how this actually works. You know, we're looking at this as very orderly, and first you insert the guide wire, and then you do this and that, but Dr. Burke testified that these things don't just slide in, you know, where they're supposed to go. It's not like sliding something in to a position. There's a lot of manipulation that goes on, and he described this as the telescoping action. And so when you're talking about inserting a guide wire, that typically involves additional manipulation of continuing to sort of nudge these components forward, you know, through the cardiovascular system. And so I think the patent claims should be understood with respect to this infringement analysis with that in mind.
That wasn't part of Mr. Burke's testimony that was excluded, was it?
I'm sorry.
Was that part of Mr. Burke's testimony that was excluded, what you just told us?
No, it was that. Okay. That was not. And there's a lengthy description of advancing and how this telescoping action works and how you use, for example, if you want to advance the outer catheter into this lateral branch vein, the outer catheter is advanced over the inner catheter because to help direct it and support it as it goes in. So it's a push-pull type of a situation, and it's not just, push it all the way in, push this one over, and then there's three or four actions that you take. It's constant manipulation of these devices as the actual procedures are taking place.
Well, what is the over here. What is the function of the guide wire in particular? What would be the function if it's not actually the lead dog?
And I'm glad you asked that question. And to put that in to context, you need a little bit of background. And Dr. Niazi provides this in one of his declarations that we submitted. But when this procedure was first introduced, it was in the procedure.
What, testimony from Dr. who?
Dr. Niazi.
That I don't think is in the briefs, right?
We did include it in the background section. We did reference.
Oh, okay. Right.
And where I'm going with this is, they're referred to in the industry as a standard lead, and that lead does not involve implantation using a guide wire. For this particular purpose, a company called Guidant invented an over-the-wire lead, which is a lead that has a tube. The wire goes through the tube, and then the lead is advanced over the guide wire. And so when you look at St. Jude's instructions with this if desired language, these were really intended to cover the standard lead where you don't use a wire, and an over the wire lead where you always use a wire. And the standard leads are not at issue. They're not accused of infringement here. What we're focusing on is the over-the-wire leads that require use of a guide wire. And so this whole if-desired language is not about, well, you either choose or you choose not to use a guide wire. It's if you choose to use a standard lead or if you choose to use an over-the-wire lead. And so if you are using an over-the-wire lead, which is the predominant lead that's used, Dr. Niazi, I believe, testified that nobody uses standard leads anymore because those were designed for different types of procedures. Over-the-wire leads are designed for this particular procedure.
Okay, but if you use the over-the-wire lead process, then according to, the subselection catheter section of St. Jude's instructions for use, IFUs, you would insert the inner catheter into the outer guide catheter, and then you would subselect the branch vein with the inner catheter, and then you would introduce the wire with the lead, right, in that sequence.
Yes, that's what's described there, and I would say that precise situation is also described in the patent, where it, and again, this is cited, and I can pull up the site right now if you'd like, but what it is explaining is that sometimes it is difficult, just given the particular anatomical structures that you're presented with. You know, you can't always just get the wire into the lateral branch vein. You know, you need to get the inner catheter in there to help guide the wire through. And the patent describes those situations. I think it describes them as difficult circumstances or something along those lines. And so...
So the guide wire is actually the guided wire.
Yes, it serves multiple purposes. It helps guide the catheter in, and it also helps guide the lead in, and you use the catheters to help guide the wire. So as I said, it's a system. It's a that is, I guess, constantly being manipulated, and when you're advancing that wire into the lateral branch vein, it typically involves, you know, subsequent movements where you move the wire, then you move the catheter, then you move the wire, then you move the catheter.
But this claim has, claim 11 has been interpreted to require that the wire is advanced before the inner catheter is advanced into the greater branch vein, right?
Yes, so if I understand that correctly, and I don't believe it should be interpreted as the wire is advanced as far as it will go, or, you know, till its final place, right? You know, again, when you look at the...
It says advancing a guide wire through the catheter into a coronary sinus lateral branch vein. That's step two, and then step three is advancing the inner catheter out of a front end opening of the outer catheter along the guide wire into the branch vein. Why isn't that the opposite of what you're discussing now? Might be in your specification, but it's also what's in St. Jude's IFUs.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that step should be, you know, as I just mentioned, it should not preclude the situation that's described in the specification, where the inner catheter is perhaps placed at the opening of the lateral branch vein, then the wire is advanced through. Advancing that wire in can be step two, even if the inner catheter is already at the opening of that lateral branch vein. And then step three is accomplished by moving the inner catheter further along to help provide further support for the wire, and then for the lead that's ultimately advanced through it. So, like I said, I don't think that limitation or that particular order of limitation should be read to preclude that situation in the specification that may occur during one of these procedures. I was going to address maybe perhaps the damages issue or the sanctions issue, but I see I'm almost out of time. Unless the court has any specific questions on that or any other issues, I'll conclude.
I think we're all set.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for the argument, both sides. Case is submitted.